This is a speaker meeting. John will speak for 10 minutes and then turn the meeting over to our main speaker, Jessie, who will share her experience, strength, and hope.
Okay. Ignore that. Okay. Yeah. Hi, I'm John. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, John.
So I'm feeling a little nervous right now, so naturally I decided to drink some coffee to help me calm down. And I just wanted to thank whoever donated this mug. I'd like to read you what it said. It says beer. And there's a picture of a guy holding a beer looking very happy and says, proud sponsors of casual sex since 1858. I think that could kind of describe AA sometimes. But, so, it's okay, you can work some steps around it, you know, you're just getting willing, it's not necessarily a bad thing, but, yeah, so, I'd just like to cover a few things real quick. I don't have a lot of time, but, what my using was like, was I ended up 7 years ago in the TL. I just scored from some dude who lived on the sidewalk in a cardboard box, and he was my age. You know, and I'd waited for him at the McDonald's at Van Ness and Golden Gate while some guy was inside trying to find a vein, spraying blood all over the bathroom stall. And I'm a suburban kid from Saratoga, so I was a little bit out of place. At least some might think so, but I remember clearly, like, I had just gotten that, you know, and I hope I'm not alienating anybody who's, like, a pure alcoholic, if there are any of those left. I see one hand back there. It's really, like, I think it's just, like, a manifestation of the same disease, you know, in different forms. But, so I remember clearly sitting at this bus stop, and I looked up, and in my loaded brain, I saw this like banner for a law school that was right there, and I thought to myself, "Man, I bet that's a great place to go to school." And it wasn't even like a pipe dream, you know what I mean? Like, it wasn't like maybe if I do this, do that. Like, I'd have a lot of those when I got loaded enough, you know, drunk enough. Like, I could conquer the world, you know. And sometimes, you know, when at least I felt like I could for brief intervals. And it wasn't even that. It was like, that's a whole different world, you know, closed off to me. And I'm in this, you know, and I got mine. I'm feeling all right and whatnot. And so eventually, like, you know, all the wheels fell off of that, and I had to get sober. I didn't have a choice. I mean, I had no better option. So I had tried sobriety, though, so many times before that I thought that it wasn't going to work for me this time. I really, like, didn't have a lot of faith in the program. So if you're sitting here and you've come in and out, like, 10 times, you know, 15 times, welcome. Like, I really hope that you don't believe that, like, this will not work for you. And even if you do believe that, you can still stay sober. That's my experience, you know. Like, I did not have much faith in it, but I didn't have a better option. So I was stuck with you guys, and thank God for that. You know, there was another thing that that kind of, like, had stopped me from, like, really getting the program. That was, like, developing a relationship with my higher power. And the reason for that was I thought that, like, I needed to figure out God before I could start to, you know, build that. And what I finally realized that was like this one thing that came to me, like, I guess maybe it was like a spiritual experience, but I realized, like, if God is all-powerful and all-knowing, how could I even begin to comprehend what that is with my little human brain? You know, like, there's no way I could wrap my head around that. And so I realized, like, how impossible that was, and I just gave up on trying to figure it out. And I know, I probably look like a total douchebag trying to show off my guns, but and I'm really not. It probably even makes me sound more like a douchebag. It's just really hot in here right now. I'm nervous. I'm like, my face is frozen. You know. So I should probably drink more coffee. Okay, so that was like one of the roadblocks that cleared away. The other thing was, like, I thought that there was some secret to the program that I wasn't getting. I thought that, you know, there was like, every time I'd go out, I'd blame it on the program. I'd say, oh, I didn't go to enough meetings. I didn't call my sponsor. I wasn't honest enough. I didn't do all the steps right. And sure, all those things were true, but like the bottom line was that I got drunk because I decided to drink. You know, at a core, like at a fundamental level, like that's willingness. Like my choice is to drink or not. That's what they really mean by willingness. It's kind of like a mysterious term, you know, but that, anyway, that's my interpretation of it. And so I stopped buying into those excuses, and I realized that no matter what my head told me about my, you know, about how it was going to be different this time, I could not listen to it. The basic like truth about my alcoholism is that I can't see the truth about my alcoholism. And so how can I believe my head when it tells me, you know, that it's going to be different this time? And, you know, so I couldn't take a drink no matter what, you know, and I hated when they said that. I couldn't get loaded no matter what. And I hated when they said that, because if that was enough, I wouldn't need this fucking program, right? You know, like I would just like not drink no matter what. I would not get loaded no matter what, and I'd be fine. But the thing was that like I always needed to get loaded no matter what. Like that was what it was about for me. And that didn't make a lot of sense to me. But I realized that like the starting point was that willingness, not picking up no matter what. And that, but that wasn't enough. You know, I had to do a lot more to ensure that I would be capable of doing that. Because like I said, that wasn't possible to me before. So, you know, what that was getting a sponsor, meeting with them every week, working the steps. I mean, you know, if you've been to like 3 meetings, you've heard probably like all of the basic, you know, the whole basic plan of AA. You know, it's really fundamental. It's in the big book. And so I had to work the steps in sequential order to the best of my ability. And I didn't do it perfectly. I had reservations about step 1. I didn't know if I could stay sober. I didn't even know what it meant to be an alcoholic, really, when I was willing to admit that. I thought it was just somebody who liked to drink too much, you know? And I realized that there's like a pretty precise definition. And if you're wondering about that in here tonight, it's the book says, you know, if when you honestly want to stop, you can't. Or if when you try to quit, if when you honestly want to stop, you find you cannot. Or if when drinking, you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic. And if you're unsure, step over to the nearest bar room and try some controlled drinking. I don't recommend that. I went out on that, you know, like I figured like, oh, it says it right there in the book. I could do that. It doesn't work well, you know, but I mean, I guess they knew something I didn't, but so the steps, I worked those in sequential order. Obviously, I don't have enough time to talk about all those tonight, and I'd probably bore you to death if I did, but the three I'd like to talk about are 10, 11, and 12, which are the maintenance steps. And what that means is that, like, once you, for me, anyway, my understanding of it is that, like, once I've worked the steps all the way through the first time, I can maintain my sobriety by consistently working 10, 11, and 12. I don't need to redo the steps entirely. I mean, a lot of people get a lot out of that, and I'm not hating on that, but like my experience is to like consistently work 10, 11, and 12. Well, ideally, to work 10, 11, and 12. I see my buddy laughing back there because he knows, actually. I've been like sitting on an inventory for, I don't know, maybe a few months, like that I'd written out. I'd done this 10th step. That's what the 10th step is. Continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. And it's basically 4 and 5, and then 8 and 9, kind of all wrapped into one, and revisited. Thank you. So it's like those 4 steps revisited. And I've been sitting on that for a long time, and I was spiritually sick. I mean, I was like, you know, they talk about it as like a dry drunk, you know. I was like the desert. And I didn't realize it because it happened so slowly. You know, I was just under stress. And I wrote it off as, you know, like situational and like circumstantial, and it's not my fault, it's these people, and blah, 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 you know, and all those justifications. And I didn't realize how much it was building up in me. And when I went to this meeting, it was a 10th and 11th step meeting, a men's meeting, and I knew I needed it. I'd written out this inventory, but I hadn't shared it. I'd been too busy, my sponsor had been too busy, whatever, hadn't made it a priority. And when I showed up there, and like the instant I put pen to paper, I could feel the relief wash over me. And as I tell you that now, I kind of like get goosebumps thinking about it, because like the steps have done for me what alcohol and drugs did for me. Now, they don't do it like, they didn't do it instantaneously like the first time I did it. You know, it takes practice. It's kind of like, it's kind of like getting loaded, actually. You know, like a gateway drug. Like when you first come in and you go to meetings, you know, meetings are like your gateway drug into AA. And then after you stay here a while, if you're like alcoholic and an addict enough, I think that like eventually you need more. You need a lot more. And that's where a sponsor comes in, because they're like your dealer. And they hook you up with the purest stuff there's ever been, which is conscious contact with your higher power. They're like the cartel. And, you know, it's kind of an amusing analogy, but it's true. You know, and it's true from my own experience. Like, I mean, obviously I don't have experience with a cartel. Except, like, extremely tenuous experience. So I need to wrap it up. I probably have less than a minute left. And I just want to say, like, so there's 10, 11, 11 sought through prayer and meditation and improve our conscious contact with God as we understand it. And when I feel that connection, I feel that effect that, like I said, that alcohol and drugs did for me. And it only works as well as like the effort I'm willing to put into it. You know, it's not magic, and it takes consistent effort on my part. And it usually, I like to start it first thing in the morning. You know, I hit my knees first thing in the morning, pray, and then if possible, meditate a little bit. And the 12th step, you know, continue to... 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. And I recently went to Wacky Paw in Denver, and I had one of the most spiritual experiences in my life, where I was standing outside, pissed off, like, about this thing, didn't even matter, and all of a sudden this newcomer just randomly walked up to me. And he wasn't, like, from the concert. I mean, from the convention. He was just, like, a random guy who had, like, been partying in the hotel and just found his way to our, like, smoking circle and asked me what this was all about. And I got so excited, I think it probably, like, freaked him out a little bit. But I was really juiced for it. And I, like, brought him inside, and we had a meeting for him, like, an impromptu meeting with, like, 100 people. They like stopped, "Love thy neighbor," and of course he left like halfway through. But he came back the next night, and as far as I know, he's still sober today. But you know, that's like what keeps me sober. That's like but that's not all that can keep me sober. You know, I gotta be well. You know, I gotta take care of myself. But as long as I'm doing that, I can reach another level. And I'll close with this. Keep it simple. Service, inventory, meditation, prayer, literally every day. Thank you.
Now I'd like to turn the meeting over to Jesse.
Friday is February 29th, 2004. I have a sponsor who asked me this morning she's the speaker picker for this meeting, so she sent me a text at like 6 a.m. this morning, like, can you speak tonight? I was like, yeah, sure. And then so I spent the next several hours thinking about like all the wisdom I was going to impart, you know, thinking about all the awesomeness, you know, because my first instinct still, even, you know, with 10 years sober, is to think about like myself, think about like the image that I want to put into everybody's head about how awesome I am or how perfect my sobriety has been, how funny I am, how, you know, all these different things, and it's like I have to keep reminding myself to bring it back to like the reason that we meet, the reason that we all meet here today, the reason that I'm asked to speak, anything like that, is for someone who's new to the program, someone who's struggling with the program, for me to share my experience, for potentially for somebody to identify with me and see that I was able to find a solution in here, and so maybe that somebody else in here will be able to find a solution. That it's not about me coming up here to share and like brag, you know. But at the same time, it's also not, you know, I heard this amazing speaker talk about how sometimes we come up here and we get some time and we're overly modest and we share about how we're still screwing up and our alcoholism is still so crazy and I still feel like a newcomer every day. And that's actually not true, you know. 10 years sober, my life is a hell of a lot better than how it was 10 years ago. And, you know, if I feel like a newcomer today, it's probably because I'm not talking to any newcomers. You know, that if I actually am encountering, you know, if I'm talking to people that are brand new coming in off, you know, coming into AA, I recognize that my life today is way better than how it was when I first came in 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And I have a home group. My home group is Sunday night, Vision for You. And home group's really important to me. I got sober in like a really tight-knit home group. And it was all about, you know, I was kind of used to showing up to different things. Like, I show up to a party and, like, take everything I could get. And sometimes I still do that. Like, I go to the snack table, I take all the snacks I can take. I just show up to anything I could do, you know, everything. I was showing up and just taking what I wanted and then just being like, all right, cool, that was, you know, peace out. And as a home group member, you know, I show up and I contribute, you know, and I commit to being a part of a group, not just when it's convenient for me. Because I also didn't really know, and I struggled to know, like, what does commitment mean? And commitment is like, oh, I go when I feel like it. When I don't feel like it, I don't go. It's like, what kind of definition of commitment is that? You know, so I try to, you know, so it's not, if it's the home group, I go even when it's inconvenient for me. Whenever I'm in the zip code, you know, whenever I'm in this, you know, in the neighborhood, I go. Not just when it feels good to me. So I have a sponsor, a sobriety date, a home group. And a sponsor for me is somebody that has what I want. You know, so that was what was told to me when I first got sober. So someone, what I wanted when I was brand new is I went up to this, like, tiny, cute, bubbly blonde chick, and I was like, will you be my sponsor? You have what I want. And luckily she did have an awesome program, and she was more than just cute. And she got me involved, you know, in a program. And I want to briefly, you know, sometimes I talk too much about what it was like before and not enough about what it's like now. So I just want to talk about, you know, kind of how the program is in my life today. You know, I still have an alcoholic mind, very much an alcoholic mind, you know. What qualifies me to be an Alcoholics Anonymous today? Because a lot of times you hear different definitions of what alcoholism, I mean, they have like 15 different definitions of alcoholism in the big book alone, you know. And so a lot of times it can be confusing, like, how do I know I'm an alcoholic? How do I know I belong here? And for me, I love the description that's in the doctor's opinion about, like, what we have. The disease that we have is a combination of a physical allergy, like a physical reaction to alcohol, and for me it's drugs too, and for me it's also a lot of other things, but, you know, most importantly, the only one that I have to have is I have a physical allergy to alcohol. And what happens when I consume alcohol is I have the allergy. Instead of, you know, allergic to strawberries, you break out in hives, allergic to, you know, dairy, you know, poop too much. If I have an allergy to alcohol, the reaction that happens in my body is called craving. I get the phenomenon of craving. I put alcohol in my body and it's like a physical reaction, you know, goosebumps, everything. I want to put it in my body. I've got to put so much of it in my body until I black out, pass out, it's taken away from me, I'm locked up. Or if it's not around me, I'm just super, super uncomfortable. And so then, you know, if we just had that allergy and you could just tell us, hey, you've got this allergy to alcohol, you get a craving when you put it in your body, don't drink it, we would not need AA. If we could just stop drinking at that point, we wouldn't need AA. So the harder part of my disease is that I also have the mental obsession. And the mental obsession occurs with my sober brain. My sober brain has a mental obsession with being different, with drinking differently this time. This time it's going to be different. I loved at the beginning of this meeting, we read that part of More About Alcoholism where it says, through every means of self-deception and experimentation, I try to prove myself an exception to the rule and therefore non-alcoholic. That is what my sober brain does every morning when I wake up. Every morning when I wake up, I try to prove through self-deception and experimentation that I am an exception to the rule. You know, I do that today. That's a huge thing for me too. It's like I try and violate cause and effect. I'm like, I'm going to eat this entire family-sized bag of Oreos and I am not going to gain weight. You know, I'm going to go and I'm going to, like, try and date this guy that we've already broken up 10 different times and it's going to work this time. Like, I'm going to, you know, my mom is
not, you know, I'm going to go and I'm going to leave all dishes all over the counter and my mom is not going to get mad at me. You know, like, I try to prove myself. I try to, like, change all these different things, you know, to try and prove that it's going to be different this time. And that is my sober brain. So really, my drunk brain isn't really a problem, because once I stop drinking, my drunk brain is not really in the picture anymore. So my alcoholic mind is actually referring to my sober brain that happens. So what happens is I have the sober brain trying to prove me to the exception to the rule, and then I start kind of like tinkering with this idea of how this is not a time I'm going to drink some water, or I'm going to eat a big bowl of pasta before I drink, or I'm going to hang out with these people. And then I convince myself to drink, and I just think I've changed my mind. I just think that I made this empowered decision that I'm going to drink, and it was really smart of me, and look how I thought that out. And I love, too, you know, talks about more about alcoholism, about, you know, Jim, the guy who pours a little bit of whiskey in his milk, you know. And I don't relate to whiskey in the milk, but what I relate to is he says, suddenly the thought crossed my mind. You know, he has this big thought, boom, in his brain. And it says, I vaguely sensed I wasn't being too smart. You know, and so that's the kind of comparison of, like, the alcoholic thought, sudden, boom, here, right in front of me. The same thought, vague, or sometimes it doesn't even occur at all. And that's, you know, all throughout that chapter, they're talking about all these different things that will not keep me sober. Self-knowledge doesn't keep me sober. Fear doesn't keep me sober. The fact that I know what's going to happen when I drink won't keep me sober. The fact that I don't want to drink anymore doesn't keep me sober. The fact that I think I'm done and I don't have enough sobriety in me won't keep me sober. The only thing that keeps me sober is a connection to a higher power. It's training my feet so thoroughly that my feet end up in a meeting while I'm still deciding to drink. You know, and the people surround me, you know. And that's, you know, so that's what my alcoholism today. So, you know, I have this two-part disease. I have the mental obsession, I have the physical craving, but the mental obsession is the problem. So I come here, I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, because when I talk about how bad it was, that reminds me. When I hear how bad it was for you, that reminds me. And most importantly, when I sit down with someone who's brand new to Alcoholics Anonymous and I get to, you know, share my experience with them, I'm getting to keep sober myself. I don't know if it'll keep them sober, but I'm getting to keep sober myself. You know, and that's for me, it's like the most important person being the newcomer is that, you know, when I was brand new, I mean, I was sort of like crazy and I was 17 and I was like, ah, you know, and I thought AA was really cool because I loved the stories and, but I was scared. I didn't really know how to build relationships. I didn't know how to pick up the phone, you know, so for me today, you know, my sobriety depends on me picking up the phone and calling newcomers at 10 years sober. I don't at some point graduate to where I don't have to do that anymore. Because my sobriety depends upon it. You know, if I'm not constantly keeping in my mind the thought of other people, I'm not going to stay sober. You know, and I also, more importantly, I'm not going to think I have anything to offer. I'm going to start thinking I don't have anything to offer because nobody's calling me. You know, but if I'm picking up the phone first and I'm calling people and I'm sponsoring people, I start to believe that I have something to offer. I start to believe my life is worth living. And that it was at the core of a lot of the reasons why I drank and used is because I didn't believe I had a life worth living for anyway. So why wouldn't I just go get drunk? And you know, that's one of the things that AA has given me today. So some of those things of proving myself an exception to the rule, you know, those things still happen for me on a daily basis. You know, again, like I said, with food or with relationships or these other things that we all have, something like that. We all have our money, our gambling, our shopping, whatever the other things are. And I love that I have those problems today because it reminds me how strong this alcoholic brain is. I get to see on a daily basis how strong my alcoholic brain is. And why do I think if I put alcohol back in my life that for some reason that alcoholic brain wouldn't apply there again? You know, so what it was like, you know, what my using and drinking was like is the first time I used any kind of substance when I was 11. You know, it was just that same thing, the craving, the physical craving, wanting more. And then, you know, where mine took me, I was in, you know, I got sent to my first wilderness program when I was 14. And got sent to another wilderness program when I was 17. And, you know, I got sent away, you know, I got sent away to these programs. I thought I was cured. I came back. But I thought it was still something that I could control with my mind. You know, I thought it was something where I was choosing to do it this way or I was choosing to do it that way and didn't recognize that I had a disease that I couldn't control. And so where my bottom took me, you know, was I was, you know, started my senior year as president of the class. I had, like, kind of scooped myself up after my first wilderness program that I went to when I was 14. So started my senior year of high school around here, president of my class, president of the poetry club, varsity, softball, applying to colleges, 4.0 GPA, editor-in-chief of the paper, you know, very alcoholic, had to be the head of everything, you know, I never delegated, and so
I was always stressed out. That's another thing that, like, in sobriety, like, I love being stressed out. Like, give me more responsibility so I can complain about them. I was doing that then. I didn't know what that was. I just thought it was because I was the only one capable. But then I was still, you know, I also, because I like to juggle everything, I like to see as many plates as I can get going before they all tumble. I was also just drinking and using, you know, first it was on the weekends, and then, it's like a magnetic pole where the time frame starts to migrate inward. It was like weekend, and then, the weekend extends, and then it was like, I was kind of like the garbage header. It was like anybody that I could hang out with, anything I could do, I would do, because I just had a hard time. You know, I just wanted to feel different all the time. That was at the core. I was like, I wanted to feel different. You know, for me, I kind of managed it. I might have graduated high school. I might have, you know, kind of gotten things together. But then I met a guy at the 7-Eleven on Thornhill who drank and used exactly like I did. And he had been kicked out of several high schools and had all the time in the world. And I really admired that. You know, I thought it was really courageous. He had all the time, you know, he had all the time in the world to drink and use. And so I started to, you know, and again, like, so it's sort of this catastrophic combination of, you know, codependency, being addicted to a person, being addicted to a substance, and kind of rolling that all into one hot steamy fireball. And, I hung out with him every single day, and every single time we hung out, it was always like, where are we going to get this? How are we going to get this? How are we going to get money? Very quickly started to turn into, like, ripping people off. Quickly after that started to turn into not going to school, not coming home at night, police getting called on me, you know, fights with my parents, not going. It's just one of these things where there's a line in one of the stories in the big book that says, a normal person adjusts their behavior to meet their goals. An alcoholic adjusts their goals to meet their behavior. I had a goal of graduating high school, you know, and so a normal person would say, like, okay, I have to go to school, I have to do homework, you know. But it was like, no, my behavior, the behavior of, like, wanting to be with this guy all the time, wanting to be hot all the time, didn't really fit with my goal. So I started to change the goal, you know, started to adjust it. And that's just our mind's way of coping with things. You know, because how can I want this thing so bad to graduate high school and then be on a daily basis pummeling it? So what I had to believe, I started to convince myself that, like, school was the man, and I wasn't going to give into that, and I was alternative, and I was an artist or whatever. You know, I had, like, a different way of thinking, and I was going to prove, you know, again, trying through self-deception and experimentation to prove myself an exception to the rule. I'm going to be different. I'm not going to be a failure of a high school dropout. I'm going to be a special high school dropout, and I'm going to be successful. I'm going to be a nomad. I'm going to roam the streets preaching about peace, whatever. So one after another, like, I was a star pitcher on the softball team. You know, no, don't want to do that anymore because exercise. I don't know. Like, I didn't want to, or I was on the student council. You know, so it's just like the amount of energy it takes to constantly be, like, justifying why I'm failing is so much, and it makes me so defensive. Because the moment that anybody's like, oh, I'm having a good day, I'm like, oh, I don't know, why are you trying to say that? I'm not having a good day. If I'm not living in accordance with my own values, then everybody who's living in accordance with their own values is a threat to me. You know, if I'm not being honest, then everybody who's honest is a threat to me. Anybody who's asking me how I'm doing, you know, I'm like, oh, they can't see. You know, I don't want them to see through my wall of lies, deception, and self-hatred. So, you know, everything, I just am constantly on guard and edgy and, it doesn't really make for any kind of healthy relationship development, except for relationships that are based on control or being dominated. You know, so those are the only kinds of relationships I have, were people that were tools in my life or people that I was a tool in their life. You know, it was a means to an end. My relationships were all means to ends. And the moment that the person stopped functioning as a means, they were out, or vice versa. And that's not a relationship. I've learned that in sobriety. That's not what a relationship is. So what ended up happening is, you know, all these good things slowly kind of falling away one after another. 53 days left of high school. This guy decided that he's getting kicked out of his house. He's going to move away to LA. And I, you know, with my, I had 10 days sober at that point, so I was really thinking clearly. And I decided that I should drop out of high school and run away with him that day. So several hours later, I got a huge blow up with my parents. And stole their car, stole their money, you know, ran away to LA with them. And it was just so funny because it's like that when I'm using and drinking, I have this incredible ability to convince myself that I'm doing the right thing. You know, because it is so painful for me to be wrong. It is so painful for me to admit that I'm wrong. I will spin, like, the most crazy, like, smoke and mirrors to convince myself that it is amazing. You know, just like if, for example, that week, the reason that I was driven to run away from home and driven to be with this guy is because I was in the pursuit of freedom and happiness. And I thought I should be able to go through anything and anyone to be free and to be happy. You know, and that is my right. And so running away, you know, what the days actually looks like is we're like huddled inside of his friend's apartment in a room with no furniture, just like a nasty blanket that I had in my car. You know, and we're like huddled in there. Every time a cop car went by or anything, we're like freaking out. Both of us have these like phones that are constantly ringing with like our friends and family leaving these voicemails. You know, and we're like, we don't have any money between us because we didn't, because neither of us were working. And so we were like constantly scheming and then trying to like find things in this guy's cupboard, you know, that we could make. Didn't have money. I mean, there's some other, you know, like gory details. And my alcoholic brain was like, this is freedom, you know, and that it's like the Janis Joplin song of like, freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose, where it's like, I have nothing to lose, you know, I'm at the bottom of the totem pole. And I thought that was freedom. I thought having no one expect anything of me was freedom, when in reality, freedom is having a bountiful amount of choices, you know, which is what I have today. Now I know I'm free because I can choose to like wake up and go to school or not go to school because I'm enrolled in school, or I can choose to like be friends with these people or not be friends with people because I have the option to be friends with people. And when I'm like living my alcoholic life and I'm tearing everything down, it feels free because I'm like, nobody's calling me, nobody needs me to be anywhere, nobody wants to see me. But that's not, you know, that's not really freedom. That's actually like a self-constructed prison of like no choice. You know, I have no choice but to continue driven by my desires and my instincts. You know, I'm a totally instinct-driven person. And that's, I think a lot of us deal with that, where we're like, we think we're these free, outgoing, loving, you know, people, but really we're totally imprisoned by our instincts. My instinct to get high was domineering, and I couldn't fight that, you know. And so, you know, I got picked up by the police and got put into Herrick Hospital, got 5150'd, and then got sent out to another wilderness program, and then a rehab program, and then a halfway house. And I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous through these different programs. And for me, it was, you know, actually the meeting that I was at this morning, the woman read out of There is a Solution, where it says, you know, kind of what I think is a really great example for, like, why would I commit to Alcoholics Anonymous? It says, like, none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of defects, which, are required for the successful consummation of this program. And it's true. I wasn't like, yay, I want to go confess. I want to go, like, write a lot. And, you know, it says that we'd come to see the futility, like, the hopelessness of the way that I had been living life, and I'd come to believe that it really worked in others. And that was something that I went to enough meetings where I saw people that were laughing, I saw people that were happy. I also saw people that, like, I hadn't been around enough to see people change, but I heard people's stories where I was like, oh my gosh, this guy woke up, like, his house is on fire, and he was, like, butt naked in a snowbank, and now look at him, like, he's stressed. And, you know, and hearing these stories over and over again where I was like, I cannot believe that person was in this place. You know, and starting to see, like, something is happening in here, you know, and I want a part of that. And, like, maybe whatever that is that's happening in here might be able to happen with me. I might be able to tap into that power. And I love that in We Agnostics, there's one part where it talks about, like, you know, that whole, like, either God is everything or God is nothing. What is our choice to be? And it says, arrived at this point, you know, we had to make a decision or whatever. And it's like, we arrived at that point over and over and over again. You know, so I arrived at that point, you know, early on in sobriety where it was like, either this God thing is working in here or it's not. And today I'm going to decide that it is working and I want a part of this. You know, I want it to work in my life the same way it's working in all these people's lives. You know, so I got that sponsor and I started, you know, getting involved with this home group. And she taught me a lot of the sort of fundamental things about, like, be where you said you're going to be when you said you're going to be there. If you're going to be late, let somebody know. And that was like, whoa, oh my God. Like, that was mind-blowing. And it was like so many of my life problems, like, went away just applying that, you know, because I was always like fighting people about, like, you know, well, this is why, you know, or just, like, apologize or if I'm late. And she also, you know, was talking about acting my way into right thinking instead of trying to think my way into right action. And that was something where I was, like, always, like, sitting at home just, like, waiting to get the feeling. I'm going to get the feeling that I can go. I'm going to get the feeling of going to a meeting and then I'll go. And I was like, I just don't feel like going. And it's like, if I just, like, lived my life doing things, only the things I felt like doing, I would do nothing. I'd probably be dead, you know? Because I feel like being dead still sometimes. But, you know, knowing that, starting to learn, like, I can train my feet to do things so that I show up. And then I'll get the feeling afterward. And so that home group taught me about that. They also, you know, They got us really involved in like reaching out our hands, like meeting people, starting to develop this community, like this family that I'm choosing. You know, that Alcoholics Anonymous is not like some little like thing that I put in a box and like I put it under my bed or whatever and I leave it there and I like, open it up when I like, you know, want to connect to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's like it becomes a part of my life. You know, it becomes a part of my life where the way that I learned how to interact with you guys in here, like this is a safe environment, we all have the language of the steps, you know, I have a sponsor, like we kind of take care of each other in here. I begin to learn how to practice this outside of here. You know, and it says that early on in the book where it says a much more important demonstration of these principles happens outside in our homes, our occupations, and our affairs. So I don't get sober to live my life in AA. I don't get sober to stand here and be like, I'm so sober, I'm speaking in front of all these people. You know, I get sober so that I can show up to work and be an honest person. You know, so that I can show up for my family and learn how to contribute. So that I can, you know, not be constantly like gripping on to like holding on to expectations for other people. And what I loved, you know, John, we're talking about the steps 11 and 12, you know, 10, 11, and 12. Another example of like how this is in my life today, I moved here from D.C. at the end of July. And I went back to D.C. early this week. And I was just telling Candy about this before the meeting. But I went back to D.C. early this week. And I didn't tell anybody I was coming except for my, like, sister. And then I show up to my meetings, you know, thinking that I'm going to, like, and I'm like, why is nobody having any plans with me? I'm like, why is nobody, you know, I still have this sort of way of thinking of, like, that somehow everybody is thinking about me. You know, and so I show up, and I'm like, why didn't you cancel? Why are you having work tomorrow? Like, what? I'm here. And, you know, that I have these things. And so through the course of 3 days, I developed so many resentments. You know, and I have, you know, I have for the past, like, 5 or 6 years, I do a daily written 10-step. And in the daily written 10-step, it's, you know, I do, like, a synopsis of my day. I do, like, the things that I did well that day, the sponsees that I communicated with, you know, kind of the ways that I contributed to my day. And then I do a negative, and I do, like, where was I resentful today? And it was like, oh, my, you know, all these people, yeah. And I like writing that part down, but then it's like, oh, where was I selfish? And I'm like, oh. You know, and I write down that I'm selfish because I have these unreasonable expectations for people. I have, you know, I'm expecting them to read my mind a lot. That happens a lot. You know, I'm like, I think I'm a really good mind reader. I'm always like, well, when they do this, they really mean this. You know, so I think that everybody should be able to do that for me, too, and should know what I mean when I do something that's completely the opposite of what I mean. And so I write that down. I have unreasonable expectations. You know, I have, I expect that everybody is, well, if I was doing this, well, not everybody is Jesse. So, of course, they wouldn't do that because they're not me doing it. They're them, you know. You know, then I write, how was I dishonest? You know, and I'm dishonest because, partly because when I'm telling the story, I'm leaving a lot of things out. I'm leaving out the fact that they had a really bad day. I'm leaving out the fact that I didn't communicate anything. I'm leaving out, you know, I'm leaving a lot of things out, and that's dishonest. When I just tell you about something bad that happened to me, I'm leaving out their whole side of the story. I'm dishonest, too, because I come to a false conclusion about myself because of this thing that I resent. You know, for example, I was visiting my sister, and my sister, like, didn't want to hang out with me one night. And I come to this conclusion that she is a selfish person, character conclusion. I come to a conclusion that she doesn't care about me, character conclusion. And of course I'm going to be sore and sad and resentful and hurt if my sister doesn't care about me. But that's not the fact. You know, the fact is that she does. And I'm the one who's interpreting her actions that way. And that's dishonest of me. That's me kind of telling these lies that, you know, spin some story about me not mattering. You know, it's like, why am I still holding on to that? You know, and then where was I afraid? You know, I'm afraid. And the, for me, the big thing about a fear that kind of gets me out of these resentments is, like, if I were to let go of this resentment, what about that scares me? If I were to just treat this person like I didn't resent them, why does that freak me out? Do I think that they're going to be getting away with something? Do I think I'm forgiving them or absolving them of the guilt? You know, if I forgive them, do I feel like they're going to do it again to me? Or do I feel like the situation that happened between us doesn't matter? You know, there's all these reasons. Every single resentment that I hold on to, I get something out of it. It does something for me. You know, so I have to be willing to let go of whatever that is that the resentment does for me in order for me to move on. Otherwise, I'm going to just keep, you know, bringing it back into my life. You know, and so having this 10-step on this vacation in D.C., I mean, I spent half my vacation practically writing. But it was a lot better than, you know, spending my vacation damaging relationships, burning bridges, and making it so that I can never come back again. Which part of me wanted to do. Part of me was like, man, screw this place. I don't even come back here. And I don't have to do that. You know, when I have a feeling now, I don't have to just tear everything down. When I have a feeling, I'm able to acknowledge, like, do I want to act on this feeling? Instead of just being like, well, I have a feeling and everybody has to just kind of get out of the way. So, you know, the other parts of my program that are really important, you know, is that I've developed an incredible relationship with God, which is not something I really had any interest or part in when I came in here. And I also, you know, it's a really natural thing, I think, to come into the program and really want to, like, analyze and really think about, like, what does this whole God thing mean? What color, what's God's favorite color? You know, like, what religion does he belong to? You know, kind of doing all these sort of, like, introspective questions about what God is. And luckily I had a sponsor that was like, none of that matters. None of that matters. The only thing that matters is the actions that you take to be the kind of spiritual person you want to be today. And, you know, so it was like, the kind of spiritual person I want to be today is of service. The way that I, you know, if my higher power is like this good thing, then I experience my higher power when I feel good. So things that make me feel good in a really no strings attached kind of way is when I'm of service to people. So if I want to really be spiritual, really be connecting to God, I'm of service. I pick up the phone, I call somebody, you know, I show up somewhere, I do something for somebody else. So that, you know, like the taking, being of service is one of the most spiritual things I can do. I want to have a relationship with a God that makes it feel so that I'm not alone all the time. Because I came in here feeling super alone all the time, feeling like nobody understood me, nobody got it. And so I have a relationship with God where I'm communicating with God throughout the day. I pray in the morning. You know, I pray when I'm having a hard time. I pray when things are going well. Because I want to have a relationship with God where I'm not feeling alone, where, like, things have a purpose. That's the kind of thing I want, because I live a better life when I act like that. I don't really know if it's true, you know, but I know that I live a better life when I act like that. And so it's a matter of, like, what result do I want? And then I act that way, you know, instead of thinking that my belief not accompanied with any action is going to somehow change things. You know, if my belief accompanied by no action changed things, I wouldn't need to come to AA. Because I believed I was a good person, you know, I believed all these things when I was drinking and using, but me believing them, you know, since my action was totally not congruent with that, didn't keep me sober, didn't keep me safe. And kind of off of that, you know, that the, you know, being of service. Again, like I still have days where I do not work a perfect program. I screw anybody, you know, like several, many of the people in this room know me well enough to know that I don't, and to know that I have still many things that I struggle with, mistakes that I make on a daily basis, and you know, things that I would share. You know, anybody wants to know, they can come ask me after the meeting. But you know, but what I know is that. You know, I used to kind of take up like one little thing that I did wrong, and I put it, and it was like so heavy, it would just kind of like weigh out every single positive thing I'd ever done in my life was weighed out by one little thing I did wrong. You know, and it was like one mistake, one flaw, whatever, would mean that I was pointless, I was purposeless, I should just die, I should drink, there's no point in me living. And now, because of the spiritual program I have, because I'm a part of this thing that we have in here, I can, you know, it's like one thing that I do wrong, one mistake that I make, even if it's a mistake I make on a daily basis, which it often is, you know, it doesn't discount the fact that I deserve to be here. I deserve to live a life that's happy, joyous, and free. And also that I have something to offer. Because that's another thing we hear is people will be like, you know, newer in sobriety and say, I have nothing to offer. I can't sponsor anybody because I'm too sick and too crazy. And I am sick and I am crazy and I sponsor a lot of people. And I sponsor people not because I am so smart and so wise and so perfect. I sponsor people because I share my experience, you know, and I have a spiritual program to work through my experience. You know, I'm no better than anybody that I sponsor at all. Like, I have no more wisdom or anything like that. But the beautiful thing is I don't give advice as a sponsor. I don't have to have the answer. You know, as John was saying, like, I direct that person back to God. You know, I help them develop a relationship with God so that they are their own, you know, they have their own guidance, you know, and that guidance doesn't have to come from me. You know, and so for me, the gifts that the program has given me today. You know, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous 10 years ago in a psych ward, you know, with my hospital bracelet and those really awesome fuzzy socks. You know, and I was a high school dropout, and I believe that, like, and I remember kind of, like, doing, like, vision board type thing in the psych ward or wilderness program, one of those things. And it was like, I just want to be with this guy, and we're just going to have our little place, and, you know, that would be so awesome. That would be life in my wildest dreams. How small I dream for myself, you know? How small? Because now, you know, I graduated high school, graduated college, got my master's, and now I'm in law school. And I didn't even like school. I dropped out of school. I didn't want to be in school. And now, and not only that, like, I've become better. Like, I'm not a procrastinator anymore as much. A little bit still. I had to cancel some plans for tomorrow for some of you, because of procrastination. But not as much, you know, and, like, I, you know, and I, the same thing. Like, I didn't have a relationship with my parents, and now I live with my parents. That's how close I am with them. And talking about, you know, like restoring relationships, like being able to be part of relationships where me being in a relationship with me, you know, today means not so much, you know, that person is not a means to an end. It's not like, what is my mom doing for me today? You know, I used to wake up kind of like, what are you doing for me today? Otherwise, I'm not going to do anything for you. And, you know, just like, what about me? Poor me. Like, you know, and today it's like I try and switch that around. You know, our ego, I've heard somebody say that our ego regenerates every 90 days, and I think of it as, but for me, this is like spiritual hygiene. Like, if I go a day or two without, like, brushing my teeth or brushing my hair, I'm going to get a little funky, you know? And it's the same thing. If I go a day or two without praying, without, you know, without meditating, without checking with my sponsor, without answering my sponsee's phone calls or calling them back, or without hitting a meeting, I'm going to get a little spiritually funky. And for me, getting spiritually funky means I start to think about myself. I start to ask, what about me? I start to say, poor me, you know, and I start to think that, like, what is going on with me really, really matters a lot. And I start to think that I don't have time or energy to contribute anything to you because I really have to work on me. And I know now, like, through working on you, you know, I get to, me is taken care of, you know. I don't really have to focus on myself in order for me to be taken care of, which is, like, one of the many, you know, paradoxes that this program offers. You know, so I spent so much of my sobriety, I still do, you know, where I have these insatiable, bottomless desires. You know, I have an insatiable desire to prove that I'm right. Like, you can tell me that I'm right, and I'm like, but no, I'm more right, tell me more. I have an insatiable desire to control people, where I'm like, if a guy I'm dating like tells me he likes me, I'm like, but tell me more, you want to marry me, you know, love. You're okay with that, I'm all right. Okay, now that you don't say all that, I'm done. Insatiable. Insatiable means that it will not be satisfied. I have an insatiable desire for drugs, for alcohol. You know, for me, it's other things. You know, but if I apply the spiritual program, which for me is, you know, working with a sponsor, working the steps, most importantly, being of service, working with other people. You know, then I have a daily reprieve from that. I kind of get my spiritual hygiene going. I make a deposit in my spiritual bank account so that when it comes time to make a withdrawal, there's something in there, and I don't have to drink in order to feel okay about myself. So thank you all for listening to me. 40 minutes to talk about.